Parker book just hit shelves 2 weeks ago, I believe.
Something like that.
And Ray Fox, Eisner nominee for this year, One Soul. And Scott Chandler, who's Two Generals, was nominated last year for an Eisner. And Darwin did win two this year. The winner of three for Tale of Sand by Arkea, Ramon Perez. And I'm Robert Haynes. We won an Eisner, too, for our store in Guelph, The Dragon. And I'm part of the Schuster Awards. And I guess I was just, we want to go by order of Eisners.
this year?
Career by this year. I don't know. Hopefully everyone's familiar, but let me just kind of open it up with one. The publishers of these books are all small press, which might make them hard to get, but and interesting projects. But Ramon, I think your story is very interesting in that it's a Jim Henson book.
Yeah, it was. I was approached to do an adaptation of a screenplay Jim wrote back in the, I think it was the late 70s, around 73, the draft I worked from was written. And this was before the Muppets and all that stuff took off, so it was more of an art house kind of film, like the kind of stuff you'd see a college kid kind of struggling with after, you know, trying to find his voice and that kind of stuff. So it was interesting to adapt such, like I often compare it, if it had been made, I would have compared it to the Monkees movie Head, if you know that, or Yellow Submarine, or that kind of stuff. It would have been very much in that vein. So it was interesting to try to adapt it, I guess, 30, 40 years later, I guess now, and try to make it fun but relevant. And, you know, I mean, when I first read the first draft of it, I was like, this is some bizarre shit. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but the gut feeling said go with it, so I took the job, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah, and it's very interesting that there's hardly any words.
Yeah, very little dialogue. It was maybe like one or two sequences within the book. It was very much a visual descriptive, the screenplay, you know, like aside from a couple of dialogue moments. So it was kind of, one thing I liked about that was because Arkea, the publisher who put out the book, asked me if I wanted a scripter to kind of come in, break it down into panels and that kind of stuff, and I declined and said, if you guys don't mind, I know I have no professional reason to say it, but, you know, do you mind if I do it? And they're like, yeah, go ahead. And
so, well, there's actually a really good professional reason for it.
Yeah.
Well, said, what's a writer doing breaking a visual storytelling?
Yeah, I can't help, why
would you put a writer in the middle?
Yeah,
I can't help the feeling that if you'd gotten someone to do that, the book would have been really constrained compared to what you were able to do with it.
Well, I think you're right, because it's funny because since I've finished that project, every project I've worked on since has been, I've been given Marvel style scripts where they just give me a plot,
yeah,
and they let me do my own thing, and then they go in and dialogue it or break it down the story wise.
So they're getting their money's worth out of you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, and so now Darwin, you've been doing adaptations. Your recent career has been on the Parker series,
mm-hmm.
And that's been an experience for you. And now this is the third book, and you actually touched base with Westlake.
I was lucky enough to correspond with him, for the year leading up to the first book coming out, and. There's two ways you go about an adaptation. It's like you find something that has a kernel of something in it that you think you can grow into something wonderful. And in a situation like that, you're probably not going to be interested in dealing with the people who put together whatever it is you're adapting. Because on some level, maybe you don't have faith in the whole thing, but you see something at the heart of it that you think you can bring forward. And in the case of Parker and working with Westlake, it was the exact opposite. It was something that I thought was sublime as it stood, and it was a matter for me. It's one of the few times in my career where I just shut my mouth and listened and made sure that I knew precisely and exactly what he perceived his character to be about. And it's one of the rare times where I, you know, I'm working on something where I think I'm dealing with something that's pretty perfect, and I'm just trying to find a way to make sure I don't screw it up. Usually, you know, I find myself brought into things where there's a lot of room to improve them, or to take them in a direction that might be more interesting. But that, this series in particular, I'm just trying to find the visual equivalent of what I consider the, you know, the prose excellence that already exists.
Right, so that's a little bit different than what Ramon had to do. Mm-hmm.
I suppose, you know, in a way, not so much. Ramon, I believe, was relatively faithful.
Yeah, well, I did adjust things for the graphic novel medium. Like, I shortened sequences or changed a few things, and there was one scene that was cut out due to length. But we did felt it didn't affect the story, and we did actually speak with the Henson company about it, and they were actually pretty hands-off for the whole project, I think, because it was an unestablished work. Because I've heard they're quite hands-on with all their other stuff. Yeah, so it was actually kind of nice that they really didn't, you know, give too many suggestions in that regard. And because the script itself was very, it could be interpreted a million and one ways, and I think everybody who comes up to me at shows gives me a different interpretation of the story, which I think is kind of the charm of it.
Yeah.
But I think it was the opposite thing of what you said, your first version, where you're kind of going with the kernel and just kind of doing something with it.
Right. Well, and now, so then Scott, he also did an adaptation that you're pretty well known for, but nobody knows who originally wrote it. But Two Generals was taken from your grandfather.
Yeah, that's correct. Two Generals, for those who don't know, the book is based on my grandfather's experiences in the Second World War. It's largely based on his 1943 diary, the letters that his best friend Jack wrote home from France, and on the official war diary of their regiment. And so that was, a little different from adapting another author or another famous work. But, it's very much, having to, first of all, it's a family member, so there's a personal aspect to it, and, honoring, people who were long dead. So I guess there was that element. I never really thought of the book as an adaptation. I thought of it more as a history using, several primary sources. But I guess you could consider it an adaptation of sorts.
Right. It's kind of an evolution.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Ray, your new project, this is kind of you stretched your wings with this One Soul. Started doing a lot of ink work, and so why don't you, maybe that's a book that people aren't familiar with.
If you're not familiar with it, One Soul is a book that I wrote intended to be a story that could only possibly be delivered as a comic book, with the strengths of a comic book, or at least certain strengths of a comic book underlined. So it's a graphic novel told entirely in the very traditional 9-panel grid, so that every time you open the book up, you're faced with 18 panels, and what it is 18 different characters' entire lives from birth till death, told simultaneously. And you can read them individually, or if you choose to, you can read them all together and they will tell a single story. I believe it would be impossible to process that number of simultaneous stories in any other medium, in prose or film.
I think the first thing I said when I closed that book after I stayed up late one night reading it was, this could only be a comic. So if that was the original premise, you succeeded incredibly. My wife was sitting next to me. I said, like, this could only be done in comics form.
First thing I thought when I closed the book was, what an asshole. How did he get so good? Behind my back. I mean, it's just the greatest thing I've ever read.
It's funny because when I conceived of the book, and I talked to my wife about it, and my wife said, man, if you can pull this off, it'll be something. And I said, yeah, I hope so. And then every time I tried to tell it to anybody, before I actually made the book, it sounded like box office poison. Like, it was like 18 stories about people who are never named, And it's essentially a long poem about life and death. You know, and like obviously I'd say that to publishers and they would go, okay, next. You know?
Yeah.
But it's the kind of thing, you know, you put it down on paper and if you make it work, you make it work.
So one thing I was thinking was that maybe we want to open it up early. I mean, you guys know each other pretty well, and you can do your banter and share your answers. But you know, this is a great opportunity for the audience to access these creators. So, does somebody want to fire?
You're just wimping out, Robert.
Yeah,
you're just
true.
What is that? What moderating is now? Let's open it up to questions. We're 5 minutes in.
It's not for a conversation that we had.
No, he shows up late, then throws it out for questions in 5 minutes.
Actually, there's one thing I wanted to mention.
11 minutes, thank you.
There's one thing I wanted to mention. Actually, I just noticed it as we were sitting up here. The works that we're all talking about here and that I think we're all best known for, all of them have a heavy thread of reverence for someone or something that has passed.
That's a good point.
I kind of want to ask you guys, because to me, like that was very central to my book, and I kind of want to ask you guys if that was driving you on all your books, as hard as it seems to read on paper. I mean, part of what appeals about all three of your works to me is that they're so powerfully sincere because you obviously feel a great reverence.
We'll get to your questions soon, but that's a good one. So we'll start with that.
Go ahead, Scott. Run with that.
I mean, how much was that on your mind?
It was very much on my mind. I put off doing this book for quite a number of years. My grandfather died in 1997, and this came out in 2010. So you can see there's quite a gap there. You know, my entire career in comics sort of got started in those intervening years, and I have a lot of my grandfather's. I tell this story a lot when I talk in libraries and schools and stuff. So excuse me if you've heard it before, but. When my grandfather died in 97, I inherited a lot of his stuff. I have his medals and his helmets, and I have flags, and I have paperwork from the invasion of Normandy, and I've got a mini military museum in my house. And people, you know, friends of mine would come over for dinner or whatnot, and I would, you know, get out all the stuff, and, you know, I'd show it to them, and I'd run them through the story, and inevitably they would say to me, is this going to be your next book? And I was horrified. I would say, no. You know, are you kidding me? I mean, it's too personal. I didn't think there was any way I could reconstruct all the details of what had happened over there. Like a lot of veterans, my grandfather didn't talk much about the war, so there wasn't a lot of it that came to me from him. A lot of it is sort of investigative work that came about once I decided to do the book. So it took me years of people suggesting it to me before I finally decided, well, you know, maybe I'll sort of dip my toe in and try to do some research and see if it would even be possible. But it took a lot of cajoling from people. And then for the 3 years that I was working on the book, I struggled a lot with, I mean, I'm a pretty confident guy, but I struggled a lot with, should I be doing this at all? Am I doing a good enough job? You know, I don't have a lot of spiritual beliefs or anything, but I kept imagining my grandfather's ghost just walking in and just start kicking my ass, you know, because he was a very private man, and I struggled with that a lot. And especially when I got into the research about his friend Jack and had contact with his family, there was a lot of, well, now it's not just my family involved in this, it's another family as well. What if I screw this up? So there was a lot of... there was a lot. I'm surprised I got through it. I'm surprised I didn't.
Don't you think that's something that actually drives the good work, though?
Yeah.
Like I think fear? So. Yeah, I think you got to be out there to a certain extent, and I was certainly out there on this project.
I don't think there's a single work that I've ever read that I think isn't a single work that I think is magnificent that I haven't heard the creator say, "I'm surprised I got through it."
Yeah.
Sure, I know. Certainly not as personal a story as Ray or Scott have, but you know, we talk about the things we love, you know, and if there was one thing I've loved my, you know, entire adult life, it was the Parker novels. And I had tried on a couple of occasions to find a way to get that project off the ground, and it didn't get anywhere, and I finally ended up, you know, one of my best friends, Scott Dunbier is editor at IDW, and when he moved over to IDW, he said, what are we going to do? And I said, well, get me the license for this, and I'll work for you until I drop dead. And 2 weeks later, he had the license.
Nice.
Which kind of shocked me. Yeah. I got to work for this guy now until I drop dead. But they put me in touch with Donald Westlake, the author. And, you know, it's hard for me to imagine anybody that I had more respect for. And I was lucky enough to have, you know, a couple months where we corresponded quite regularly as we developed this. And, you know, taking a page from Scott, I mean, I'm nothing if I'm not confident. And you sort of move into the situation and you think you have it all figured out. And then I talked to the man who really had it figured out, and I realized how much of it I had wrong. And he was more than happy to tell me about everything.
Yeah.
And he actually, he thought it was a pointless exercise. He didn't think it was worth doing, and he actually didn't think I was the right guy to do it. And I had to convince him over, you know, a great deal of correspondence and work that I would send him. And he was ultimately convinced. And then you are shouldering the burden, I suppose, of making sure that you don't let down somebody that you admire greatly, and that you don't disturb or destroy something that they were able to accomplish without a false step. And, you know, it's so sad, but it was like 2 days before Christmas. I had the first half of the book done, and I was gonna send Don a PDF of the book. And he's, you know, he was in his 70s, and I thought, no, you know, he's gonna wanna just see a hard copy. So I printed the whole thing out, and I FedExed it down to him. There was a gigantic snowstorm on the eastern seaboard that day. And FedEx ended up 2 days behind. And he phoned and said, I'm not going to be able to see it because we're going to Mexico for the holidays. But I get home January 4th and it'll be waiting for me. I can't wait to see it. And he died on the trip. And, you know, that was tough. That was really hard. And what lay beyond even getting over that was then having to do it without him. And the notion, you know, that you could fail. I'm just gonna stop talking.
But that, yeah, like that, that weighs on you. But I think that ends up lending you so much weight as you're working. Right, like you consider so heavily what you're doing, Ramon. Too, I mean, you were working with Jim Henson's legacy. I'm sure you knew that every page, right?
Yeah, I mean, my story's not as personal as what I've heard across the table here, but I, you know, being a kid of the '70s, I definitely grew up on Jim's work with the Muppets and Sesame Street and that kind of stuff. His later work, I didn't really watch a lot of, like The Labyrinth and that kind of thing, but. When I was approached along with 10 other artists, and we all put in samples, like a couple sample pieces based on what we read of the script. And basically the Henson Company, who's run by his daughter Lisa Henson, basically chose the artist based on those samples, and you know, I won the draw basically. And then I was in, but at the same time, this script also introduced me to this world of Jim's work that I didn't know existed before the Muppets. And so the Henson Company was actually kind enough to send me over a bunch of DVDs of experimental shorts he did, like commercials, like the kind of work that you're doing as you're starting off your career in the arts, your odd jobs that he would do. That, but you could see all this different creativity that he had, kind of that he was bringing to the table. And then he had this short that was Oscar nominated called Timepiece, which was kind of like the little sister of Tale of Sand. And so I really immersed myself in this guy's headspace of that era and tried to actually think of myself of how I felt right out of college and, you know, all these ideas of grandeur I had with projects, things that maybe never saw the light of day, and tried to figure out where he was. And basically, I just kind of kept doing that. And then as I began working on it, and I, you know, like I said, Arkea gave me a lot of free rein, same with the Henson Company, to really kind of approach the book how, I don't want to say how I saw fit, how, I just kind of went with it. I just started drawing, and we pretty much went from my first pass, almost, from the like my breakdowns, except for like a few small changes. And I didn't actually feel the pressure, because everybody kept asking me through the course of the thing, like, oh, you know, like, you must be a lot of pressure, you know, Jim Henson legacy. And I was like, yeah, no, actually, it feels kind of natural. It wasn't until actually, I think, the day before the book got released, or the day of, where it just kind of like suddenly slammed down on my shoulders, going, oh my God, this could come bomb completely, because, you know, like, I went out on a limb, I tried different things, like, storytelling-wise I'd never done before professionally. So all that suddenly, and I think my editor at one point said, he's like, this will either make the company or break it. He's like, this is the most money we've...
No pressure.
Yeah, he was like, yeah, this is the most money we've ever spent on a graphic novel at this company. And I was like, oh, all right. So then, release date, I was just like, oh. And then, you know, once a few, you know, a couple of the first few reviews poured in, I was like, okay. So yeah, I'm...
It's going to be all right.
Yeah, it's going to be all right.
I think the one thing, like I said to Ray, but in Tail Sand, and I've been kind of meaning to ask you this since the gallery show, Complex Lounge, and I saw the originals, but I mean, you clearly stretched your wings. It was incredibly obvious, the techniques and just style. I mean, because you had drawn some Wildcats.
So obvious.
but it's good, you know? And you said it yourself, you tried new techniques.
Well, I mean... I think I went back to the well with things I hadn't done in a while, like painting stuff, like ink washes and that sort of thing. Originally, the company wanted me to ink wash the whole book. They were like, because when they contacted me, they said, I asked, you know, I worked in a few different styles. What do you see? You know, what are you thinking? And they sent me a hodgepodge of images for my website, which included, I don't know if people are familiar, I did a comic called Butternut Squash, which is like this really cartoony, and then they sent me these paintings I'd done for theater companies, and I was like, "What?" I'm like trying to figure this out, bring this all together in my head, and so eventually, you know, I just kind of said, "Okay, you're not going to get a painted book because the schedule was very tight." I said, "It's not going to happen," so I mentally tried to create a reasoning why I would break into things like that, and so there's, I don't know if it actually comes across, but you know, certain moments they lend, you know, a little bit of weight to them. I would go into a different medium and that kind of thing. And but it's, I think it was just the company allowing me to do something unfettered, like just allowing me to do what I do without someone looking over the shoulder or being tied to a very tight script that's, you know, every panel is blocked out, you know. And I think that just was liberating and allowed me the freedom to do, I guess, what I do best, kind of thing. I mean, it's just like go out there and draw and create and tell a story.
I think ultimately, you know, anyone who considers themselves a real artist or would like to consider themselves a real artist will always stretch when no one tells them they can't.
Yeah. So.
I kind of hogged us with the question I was dying now. So you guys, if you want to ask any questions, please go.
Who's got a question? Come on.
Yeah, let's go.
Fire away. Plaid shirt.
Yeah, multi-moderated.
You mentioned before that there are certain elements that are best fit for graphic novels, but when you're adapting a narrative into a graphic novel, how hard is it to preserve the story while inputting some of those elements that would only be fit for a graphic novel?
Depends on what you're adapting.
Well, I mean, in your case.
Well, in my case, it's really easy because he was writing those books in a style that's incredibly spare. You know, it was never a wingback chair with oak legs. You know, it was a chair. And those books are written that way. And they top out at 110 pages. And yeah, in a 130-page graphic novel, I generally find I have to cut one scene out of that book to make it. And it's because he wrote that way. Now, to pull a novel out of my head, say to adapt Henri Pierrot's Papillon, Yeah, it wouldn't be like that.
There'd be a lot of adapting there.
Yeah, right? You know, it's like, well, if you've seen the film, for example, just to pull it down to a 2.5 hour story, you know, what it would take. So it's very material specific. And again, you know, what is it you're trying to express in the graphic novel? If you're trying to capture everything that was in the sprawling 500-page novel, that's impossible.
But also, I mean, not just specifically in terms of visuals, but in terms of the flow of the story, did you find that you had to change the flow of the story, you know, just because it was a different medium?
Here and there, but not much. Not with Donald's work. He knew how to snap a transition. He knew how to end a scene and start a scene. And so, no, it's really easy work for me. I have a great writer, so.
Yeah, I guess the real work of adapting and something like that, like you can see that Darwin really uses the real estate on the page, which is something that Westlake would not have had to worry about. He was writing in prose, right? But the use of that real estate is you're just transmitting the mood that would just be in prose. Right?
You're trying to turn words into something that you can feel with your eyes, I guess, is the best way to put it. You know, and so much of that type of work is that you'll read this exquisite prose that spells something out perfectly. And you go, okay, what's the visual equivalent of this prose?
I always think of it in comics that the text, you can control the speed that somebody's reading a page with the text, right? So the text becomes like the percussion or the rhythm section of your graphic work, if you think of it in musical terms, right? And then the rest of your page is your melody and your tone and all that, right? So that's very interesting to me, to adapt a prose novel, because then you have to pull from the text, you have to create that rhythm section from the text where they wove the whole thing.
If you're really trying to adapt it properly, there's this idea of you're translating the words into images that the eye can assimilate in the same way, that the collection of words would give you the same idea. It's challenging.
When it comes to, again, my book can probably be considered, you know, loosely an adaptation of a few different sources. When it comes to me, my book was published by McClellan and Stewart, so not a comics publisher. So this book is actually better known to a sort of civilian audience.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah, exactly. Not a small press publisher, as Robert asserted at the beginning there. But because of that, I get a lot of... particularly when I'm not at comics events, I get a lot of the question, well, you know, why comics for this material? And, I think it'd probably be pretty obvious to this audience, but, you know, comics has a wonderful, like the medium has a wonderful ability to explain. I mean, look at Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics is a perfect example of that. So,
Not the first one.
So, I mean, in places in this book where, you know, text was the best way to go, I was able to use text. You know, there are entire scenes where the text drops away and I can just use visuals. There are bits where I'm having to explain some complex maneuvers where, you know, A company is over here and B company is over there. In those instances, I can switch to a map.
Exactly.
You know, I can use whatever tool in the toolbox is necessary to, you know, explain this sometimes fairly complex. And it's complex emotionally and it's complex in terms of... just the, you know, geography and strategies and all the stuff that's going on in the plot.
What you say is so true. You know, there's no other medium that can do it this way.
Exactly. And there's also, I really wanted Two Generals to capture a lot of just the entire, you know, not just the combat, but the entirety of the experience of war, which is a lot to do with just waiting around for stuff to happen. And so I, like Ray did in One Soul, I've also used a 9-panel grid. I've broken it in a few places for effect. But, you know, Ray was just talking about comics in sort of musical terms, and I think of it exactly the same way, Ray, just in terms of, you know, rhythm. And so, you know, that 9-panel grid gives a nice, you know, sort of steady, almost military-style rhythm to the thing. And then, you know, there's a lot of you know, imagery in the book of, you know, clocks and watch faces and place where I kind of, you know, refer to that
to that sense of timing. But you know, that's why comics, you know, it's you know, was absolutely the best.
You mentioned the map.
Yeah.
And in the latest Parker book, there are 12 guys robbing an entire town overnight. And there's a chapter in the book where it just says 1 a.m. and then it lists everything every guy was doing. And it says 2 a.m. and it lists what they're doing, 3 a.m. and so it goes.
Yeah.
And I read the 2 a.m. bit of it and I went, wow, you know, the only way to do this clearly is to get up overhead, show the entire town, and then just, I've got leader arrows down to the part, the street or the building that each guy's in with their name on it, so you know exactly where they are. Some of them are running across the street, some are loading a truck, but most of them are out of your sight. But for that one, 2 pages, the reader's given this perfect lay of where everything is and what's happening. And from that point on, they're able to carry that forward with them.
Yeah, it's where you get the thing. I always talk about, anyone gives me the chance, I talk about this, all of One Soul is based on it. One of the other great strengths of comics is this amazing simultaneity that you can have so much happening at once, and the reader can sort it all out. And it's like even at their own pace, yeah. And it's like it doesn't have to be in like an art house book like mine or something. Like even you go back and read some of the superhero comics that we were reading when we were kids, and like some of the stuff where they've got like 40 guys on one page fighting each other, you know, and you know, you're the 12-year-old kid who picks your favorite character out of the bottom corner of the page. But I mean, you cannot do that anywhere else. You cannot have so much going on in a single place at a single time and have the audience comfortably process it all so easily that they don't even notice that you did it, right?
Yeah. So it's not real. I mean, it's maybe not just, you know.
You know what a great example of that is? I just the wife and I just watched the Hunger Games.
Mm.
What the fuck is going on? Hey, like at some fucking point, why didn't they show me the course or introduce me to the characters?
Yeah,
you know, they're acting out of motivation that apparently is in the book. My wife was explaining this to me as we went, but yeah, it's impossible in a movie to take these things and separate them and make them that clear and poignant.
But I mean, like, you know, also the thing in the comic books and graphic novels and stuff, you also have the page turn, right? So I mean, picture if you had a way to watch that movie where you could separate out the characters that you're interested in, turn to the relevant pages to find out who they are and where they're coming from, see a map about where they all are, and see them all doing their thing all at the same time. And it's pleasant and it's comfortable, right? This is like when you watch a movie, they're just going to give you one piece of that, and if it's not the piece you wanted to see, then you're just waiting for the next part.
It's true. Yeah, my book was nonfiction. I was just looking for just the best way to compile all this research. I've never occurred to me doing it.
No, there's a tricky question. Yeah. Let me ask you.
Sure.
Because it is technically nonfiction.
Yeah.
What percentage of that book would you say is fiction? Because there, come on, well, you know, there's a percentage of it that's fiction.
Let's say it's 5% fiction. Obviously dialogue. You know, I wasn't there, so I've had to invent, you know, dialogue for scenes. But I mean, by the time I'd been through obviously I knew my grandfather well. By the time I'd read all of Jack's letters, I kind of knew his voice. So I felt like I knew the men that I was putting words in the mouth of. So I felt confident in doing that. There are a few places where my grandfather's diary and the war diary didn't agree, or where Jack's letters and the history books didn't agree, or where something somebody said and some of the veterans I interviewed didn't agree. And in that, I really began to sympathize with historians in this, because you've got to make a judgment call.
Right.
They can't both be right. So, you know, there are scenes in the book where maybe I had two possibilities and I've kind of taken one side or the other, or I've kind of invented something that was somewhere down the middle. But the idea was to get it as right as I could. Where it was possible to be absolutely factual, I have been absolutely factual. So, you know, I give myself a pretty high grade on the nonfiction versus fiction divide.
For
there.
Obama.
Yes.
Giving yourself an A.
That's right. Ramon, did you have anything to say about adaptation? We kind of missed you there.
That's okay. I was fascinated. It was interesting because adapting a screenplay, there was no scene breakdowns or anything like that. There was no cut to or middle shot or anything like that. It was very much a prose screenplay, so almost like adapting a book. And so I got to figure out where the page turns were. But the one thing I encountered, which was often alluded to in the text or in the script, was it's not word heavy or dialogue heavy, but there was a lot of allusions to music in the script, saying, you know, band will start up here, this kind of music, or he enters a town and he hears certain things. And so I was like, how do I create a soundtrack for a comic book without, you know, getting cheesy and doing, you know, and I did use sound effects. I think sound effects are great, but
he was going to say getting cheesy and using musical notes like Darwin did in the score.
No, I think I actually used musical notes. I decided to use color because Jim, in his earlier works, used to experiment a lot with color. He'd do his own these little animations where he created like sounds and explosions with papers and color and stuff like that. And so I decided to use color to be my soundtrack. So the color in the book changes depending on the mood and the sequence. I go to like tonal stuff, like as in Darwin's book. And I actually wanted to do that through most of the book, but the publisher actually wanted some full color. So hence we break into only, there's two full color scenes in the entire book where he's closest to reality, where he's in a place where he feels safe, and that's the only place I went full color, and everywhere else was either tonal or bizarre colors to evoke a certain mood, like whether it be night or danger or whatever. And just, so that was the fun part for me in adapting something like a screenplay, where I got to kind of play around with how do I interpret these things that are meant for a visual and what's the word I'm looking for? Like a motion, like a movie, basically. And I'm going to a still page with no sound attached to it. So, but it was a fun adventure.
Look, I don't want to take you there, but I'm gonna because I want the answer. Like the three of us, you know, we're talking about books we've done. You know, we had a choice to do them, and I don't think you really had a choice.
No, I wouldn't say I had a choice to do One Soul. Events in my life took me to a place where I had to ask, why are we alive at all, and what do I believe in, and is anything worth believing in? And once you ask yourself that question, if you don't answer it, you can't do anything else. So my way of answering it was thinking through the content that became the actual prose and images of One Soul. I say that One Soul was conceived as a story that could only be a comic book, and that's true, but I'm being perhaps a little bit disingenuous because really One Soul's technique of delivery was conceived as something that could only be a comic book. One Soul's story comes from that place where that very arresting kind of heart-stopping question had to be asked.
Now, how was it putting the book together? Like, was it an orderly process where you got up every morning and you worked for a set amount of hours, or was it something that came in fits and starts? It was something that
it was actually. I was working a day job at the time, and we had one young child, and so I was very busy. So it was as orderly as I could make it. Every moment where I wasn't working or caring for my daughter, I was working on One Soul. And I was making it as orderly a process as I could during that time. By necessity, it was in fits and starts, but that was only because of how much time I had available to me. It was pretty literally for a period of 2.5 years, every available moment.
Yeah, this was the other thing that hit me about Ray's book when I first read it, was that I knew you were working on it, and I kind of had a general idea what you were doing, and I told you this when I first read it, was that I was expecting to be really impressed by the, you know, formal qualities. I kind of knew he was doing this 18-panel thing and trying this thing, and I thought, well, man, if it doesn't all fall apart, it'll be brilliant. And it was. But I was
truly surprised by how emotional
exactly,
it was.
Exactly, because that structure is useless to you unless you've got heart to heap on top of it.
I opened that book thinking this is going to be a really interesting formal and experiment, and when I finished it, I was in tears. It was so emotional. Everyone should go, if you haven't read it, go get it immediately.
Actually, all three of these books, you know, if you haven't read them, I strongly recommend you read the three of the finest graphic novels you'll ever meet.
We're all sitting here at the show, too, right? We're all manning tables. I mean, we can tell people.
Well, except for Darwin's sitting across from me, and this is the first I've seen of all week, so. I don't know if we could say Darwin is manning his table, but he has one.
I am here under protest. No, I'm 50. I can't sit and draw Batman all day long. I want to, honestly, I do, but I just can't.
There's a question back there. Gentleman in the beard. Yeah.
I would say that changes from project to project, depending on how the project was conceived. Yeah. I mean, technically speaking, you know, was the genesis of my book when I thought of the storytelling technique, or was the genesis of my book when I thought of the content that I would apply to that technique, right? It was two completely different things. On the one hand, I could answer that question and say it was neither the idea nor the plot. It was, can you do things this way? On the other hand, I can answer that question and say that book is entirely about a single question.
Yeah, but without that question, you would have never decided on the structure you did.
That's true.
And without the structure you had,
you
would have never found a rhythm
to ask the question the way I wanted to.
So it's hard to answer that question.
It's almost a chicken or egg question.
Yeah, it really does vary from project to project. I had done historical material before, but it was historical fiction. I found the difference, for me, at least, between writing fiction and writing nonfiction.
That's Northwest Passage, by the way. It's still available in fine bookstores.
Thank you, Darwin. It was like night and day for me. I find fiction to be additive. You're sitting down, you're writing a story, and you're adding things until you think you're done. With nonfiction, I found it to be subtractive, which is to mean you're doing a bunch of research, and there's more research coming in all the time. Every now and then someone opens a closet and there's a bunch of old letters, and you've got to incorporate that. So that's constantly going on. And so by the time you've done your research, you've got this mountain of information. You know, I've practically got a PhD in the Second World War after the years I spent working on this book. But you can't put it all in a book. So you've got to decide what your book is about and just take those bits of factual information that speak to that plot or that theme. So I found it to be very, very different in that respect. You got anything to add?
It's interesting. Because I've done... to apply that to Tale of Sand, I mean, that was a book where I didn't even know what the story was when I started it, because the story is so open-ended. And after rereading the script constantly while working on the book, I began to develop my own interpretation. So really, I'm almost doing an interpretation of what I thought his script was, because there's stuff I added to the story that wasn't in the script to bring in more of a narrative of where I thought the story was going or what he was trying to say. But I've started other projects where, like some of my more independent projects where I start on something and I didn't know what the narrative was. I just knew the characters, and maybe 20 pages in, the characters start leading me to where they want to go, and they write themselves.
I used to think that was such bull. You know, you'd hear writers being interviewed and they always say, well, it's not up to me, the character kind of decides. And it's true, they do. They take over at a certain point, and then you realize that you're a victim of their desires.
Yeah, like I remember, like I do an online comic called Kookaburri, and when I started it, I had a vague plot outlined, and about
a third of the way in through that, that plot got thrown out the window because the characters somehow were just there drawing their story, and they just took me on this ride, and things happen. It's interesting because I felt the same way. I was like, oh, that's bullshit, and then it happened, and I'm like, oh, damn, you know.
Yeah.
So it is kind of fascinating just to have these characters that you're, because you're essentially creating these people who eventually get their own personalities and, you know how they're written.
You can even become like a hyper custodian of something you have no right to, because like in Parker, out of the three books, there have been two scenes where he did something in the book that was decidedly un Parker. There's no way he would have done that. And I changed those scenes. At the end of The Outfit, he lets a guy live. He's just spent the entire book killing everybody who's ever seen his face. And then he decides he's going to let one guy live who's seen his face to deliver a message? Absolutely not. That was a horrible mistake. And I think if Don was alive, I could have talked him into seeing that it was a mistake. But I made the decision for his character at that point. And it's like, yeah, Parker would kill this guy, plain and simple.
No, it's very much the chicken or the egg kind of scenario where each project, I think, you know, I have a few things I'm working on in the background. One's actually a historical, so I'll have to pick your brain one of these days.
Absolutely.
And I really, I have the, you know, the premise, I have the stories and the characters, but I'm still looking for the actual, you know, what I'm trying to say in the book. And so that project's been sitting on the back burner now for probably about 5 or 6 years. As I, you know, every time I go back to it, I get some more ideas and things develop. And I've often said it's, every idea has its time. I know that kind of also sounds cheesy, but I mean, like, what if you'd done Two Generals 10 years ago when you were first starting?
Too early. Yeah.
It would have been a very different book. So I think every idea has its gestation period, and when you're either confident or ready, talent-wise, as a storyteller, then that story gets told. And so, you know, that's the way I look at things.
Anyway. It's true. Like, when I did New Frontier, I was at the very tail end of my ability to harness the young side of me that was able to take all of that seriously, like 100% seriously, and play it completely straight. And honestly, when I was done that book, I knew I could never do that again.
Yeah.
You know, I just can't, because I've grown past it. And if I was, and I get approached about things like that every other week, and I just, that's gone. That's not in me anymore. You know, I go back and read it, and I'm quite proud of it, but it's the work of a younger man. And, they're trying to get me to do the next Wednesday comics. And they want me to do Batman.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, I'll do it, but it's going to be like the Adam West style Batman. He's going to have a Batmobile with an alarm on the top of it, and Robin's going to be 12.
Yes.
Please
tell me you're doing this.
And they said, well, okay. And I said, well, honestly, if you want me to do Batman ever again, that's the only way I can do it. Like, kid friendly and fun.
Yeah.
Because, I've just grown past being able to put my heart into the life and death of that. And now I'm full circle back to when I was a kid. I wanted to be fun and exciting and just and fair and complete, you know.
Now I'm looking forward to alarm clock Batmobile.
You put your hand up repeatedly. If it's 12 seconds, yes, because we're supposed to be kicked out of here.
Okay, I think I can do it 12 seconds. I'm just responding to Darwin. I'm 57. Here, the first time at Fan Expo, these other conventions in Toronto. But I kind of want to get back to the title of the session, this Canadian thing. I guess the reason I'm here is because of people, artists like yourself, who are really doing incredibly interesting, wonderful stuff that draws me in. And you know, on my bookshelf, there's a bunch of Canadian guys that are doing outstanding work. So I'm wondering, is there something there?
There's something in the water. You should have been at the Eisners this year. Best retailer?
Yeah.
Canada. Three Eisners?
Yeah.
Two here. Who else?
As a nominee.
It was ridiculous.
A lot of nominees.
It was ridiculous. If you look at us versus America in terms of per capita,
yeah.
No. Because half the Eisner nominations were Canadian guys.
Yeah, and it's ridiculous.
Yeah, the room was just full of Canadians.
They should have held it in Toronto.
I think it's because of the winters. It's different now with all the technology, but when we were kids, there was nothing. Yeah. So for 6 months, you had to find something to do, and I think it spurred a lot of creativity.
I'm glad you have a theory, because I thought we might get asked that question, and I've been beating myself up all day trying to figure out why we're producing quality work that's distinctly, like, noticed, and that so many of us are Canadian. I have no idea.
I think it's that sort of younger brother.
And there's a peer group issue here as well.
Yeah, I think it's that kind of, not necessarily trying to impress, but there's that sort of outsider quality of living, you know, it's the same reason why Canadians, you know, are supposed to have a good sense of humor and stuff. It's that ironic detachment where we're surrounded all the time by American culture, but we're also aware we're not a part of it.
And the other great thing is the amount of European culture we get here that they don't get in America.
Exactly,
and I think that's probably tempered all of our sensibilities.
Definitely. And I think we do also actually, now that I think of it, sitting at the table with you guys, we foster each other a lot. We communicate with each other a lot.
But comics are in a place now, especially in the last decade or so, where there's so much going on outside the mainstream. There's so many other genres and other things coming in, and like I say, other publishers and just so much going on. And it's a perfect place for someone with a certain outsider quality, which I think applies to a lot of us and a lot of Canadians in general. That is my theory, anyway.
That's awesome.
All right,
well, thanks, everyone. Thank you very much. I will mention
get him now.
Saturday at 4:00 at the Legal Defense Fund table. He's donated some time.
Also, I'm at table P34.
Scott's P70 for me.
And Ramon,
I have
where
no
you?
Idea. But it's the back wall.
Yeah.